This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Heart Greens. Helping to support healthy blood pressure and circulation just became hassle-free. Introducing Heart Greens, the functional food that you drink using the same dark leafy greens recommended by both the DASH and Mediterranean diets. Get a free canister of Heart Greens with your first order and a 100% money-back guarantee. Heart Greens even guarantees you'll love the taste. Call 800-951-8940. That's 800-951-8940. Or visit IntelligentGreens.com. That's IntelligentGreens.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer questions that are sent to RiaProgram@AOL.com. Be sure to listen to our weekend program. You can listen via drhoffman.com. There's a link to our live stream where you can actually call the show between noon and 2 p.m. on Saturdays. That's Eastern time. And weigh in with your questions, or if you don't want to do that, there's a bar you can click on the right side of our home screen at drhoffman.com where you'll be prompted to record a question. And if you do so, your question will be aired during our weekly radio program, and we'll answer your question there. But for today, we're simply reading questions off email. How you doing, Lila?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you doing?
Good, good. So you said in part one that we have a question about curcumin, right?
Right, right. Lisa emails us, and she's citing an article from BBC News of a Dr. Michael Mosley, who presents a broadcast called Trust Me, I'm a Doctor. Let me read you her question first. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Thank you for the wonderful podcast. You're welcome, Lisa. I'm very curious what you think of this article comparing eating turmeric, turmeric supplements, and a placebo. The article reports that eating turmeric has a significant effect on blood cells, while neither the supplement nor the placebo made any difference. And what they did was, Dr. Mosley was reporting on, they had divided a group of volunteers into three groups. They had asked one group to consume a teaspoon of turmeric every day for 6 weeks, ideally mixed with their food. The second group was asked to swallow a supplement containing the same amount of turmeric, and a third group was given the placebo. Now, the placebo group didn't really show any difference. This is not surprising. But the supplement group also didn't show a difference. However, the group who mixed the turmeric powder into their food, they saw quite substantial changes on the cellular level, and really they were investigating the genes that turn on and turn off for cancer and all of that. Now, one researcher said that it could be that adding fat or heating it up, the people who added it to their food were taking it with some kind of a fat source.
Right. Sometimes people consume it with like the golden milk. Golden milk, you know, where they put it with like a full fat milk and make it, you know, it's a drink that's used in India as part of Ayurvedic medicine.
Yeah. So generally, one of the caveats in the past with people, you know, the nutraceuticals who manufacture curcumin to take as a supplement was its bioavailability. So making it more bioavailable may have to do with the addition of the fat in the people that who were taking it with their food, making it more bioavailable. So that could be something. And, you know, they don't really specify the supplement that was used here, whether how bioavailable or not it was. So that would be also a confounder.
Well, you know,
or at the very least a question.
I have to challenge that a little bit because there are many studies that look at curcumin administration via supplements. And there are right now many manufacturers of curcumin, each claiming that theirs is more bioavailable. There's BCM95, which we actually have as Curcuplex from Zymogen. It's the company that I visited in Florida. And that has been used by Dr. A.J. Goel in research on cancer, but also, interesting, on depression, because it has an anti-inflammatory effect. It crosses the blood-brain barrier And, you know, there are perhaps also some studies on arthritis. But another form that we use for arthritis, Mareva, has been clinically shown to be as helpful as some non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. So there really are studies that support that. And then there's another one that we use now called Cogumin, specifically targeting brain inflammation, because its delivery system is said to be, you know, and again, controversial claims, said to help the curcumin traverse the blood-brain barrier. So, you know, even there are studies in India that show that per capita, first of all, they consume a lot of curry that's rich in turmeric there, that actually the incidence of Alzheimer's disease is very low. And in addition, there seems to be a dose response correlation between the amount of curry consumed and the risk of Alzheimer's disease. So it clearly, there are benefits to consuming dietary curry or curcumin or turmeric, which is a spice that we should all liberally use in our cooking, and that's going to help.
Yes.
But I think...
Especially your scrambled eggs.
Yeah, I don't think that it's unwarranted to take curcumin pills, in particular if you take them with food, and most meals... You know, unless you're on an ultra-low-fat diet, which we don't advocate, most meals do have fat to make it more bioavailable. You know, so, I mean, I took my curcumin this morning with a whole slew of other vitamins, and I had eggs, and I had a half of a sweet potato with ghee. Ghee is, you know, a great source of, I mean, that's actually how you saute traditional Indian herbs to, you know, as a, in preparation of making a curry dish. So, you know, I'm pretty sure it's getting where it needs to go to. Have you been noticing a reduction in the quality of these broadcasts? I mean, because I've been using the curcumin instead of using turmeric? I don't know. I think they're still pretty okay.
Absolutely. And listen, to absorb the carotenoids, you know, whether it's in the sweet potato or the tomato in a salad, you need to add some fat, and that's where the ghee that you use, Dr. Hoffman, or the olive oil for somebody having a salad with tomato or carrot or anything else. This is how we absorb those fat-soluble vitamins as well, and the carotenoids are that in that class. So.
Same thing with lycopene. It's actually been shown that lycopene is better absorbed in the form of tomato sauce that's made with oil than just raw tomatoes. So, you know, there you go.
Same.
Lutein. Yeah. Lutein, of course, you know, from green leafy vegetables and eggs. You know, better absorbed when there's some fat. So when you make your collard greens, you know, saute them in a little bit of butter, olive oil, or I use, for flavor, I use a little bit of, perish the thought, bacon lard. You know, I save it, and I, you know, when I make...
That's a wonderful flavor.
Yeah, collard greens, you know, with
you got to have a ham hock or something in there.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's a real southern-style dish, and it actually makes the carotenoids... more bioavailable. These are fat-soluble nutrients. Yes. They need fat to get into the body.
Right. And a reminder to all who are listening, if you're cooking in bacon fat or lard, remember that a good 48 to 49% of that fat is monounsaturated.
Isn't that interesting?
That's right. Yeah, like olive oil.
Yeah.
Right. You know, people think that it's, oh, no, saturated. But
so lard
isn't bad for us either, as we know.
Lard is Dixie olive oil, right? It's like Alabama
olive oil.
Mississippi olive oil.
There you go. Dixie olive oil. Oh, can I use that? That's great.
That's good. Well, you know what's interesting, too, is that if pigs mostly are raised in factory farms where they don't see daylight, but pigs are raised in a barnyard and they actually get exposed to the sun. You know, pigs are sort of like bald, you know, or nude. They, you know, they're not, unless they're wild boar, they don't have a rig. Thick fur.
Right. They're not hairy.
And they actually get a little sun, and the sun produces vitamin D in their lard. And their lard actually is a source of vitamin D, but only if they're not feedlot, you know, factory farmed pigs. I mean,
you've got to source your pork well, the bacon, the lard, all of that.
With apologies to our, you know, a considerable proportion of the population that eschews pork products, you know, our Jewish and Muslim friends who don't use that.
Right, right. Okay, Lisa, thank you for that very thoughtful question and article. Let's see here. We've got an email from Dan. Per your suggestion, I've begun taking Propax.
Oh, good.
I've noticed its dosage of vitamin D is fairly low. Should I be taking a separate vitamin D to supplement the difference?
Absolutely. You know, what I say about Propax is kind of a one-stop shop insurance policy because it's got a multi, it's got fish oil, and it's got NT factor, which is a great ingredient. You can get NT factor as a standalone product. It's under the brand name Healthy Aging. And some people say, look, I have my own multi that I like. I have my own fish oil that I like. I have my own probiotic. By the way, they're probiotics in Propax. And so they just take the Healthy Aging separately. The multi that is in the Propax, it's a pack, as you know, is a moderately good multi, but it's not super strong in vitamin D. So you may want to add 2,000 international units of vitamin D to your program if you're taking Propax for your, you know, your one-stop. You can sort of augment your one-stop shop and take other things. I mean, it doesn't have, for example, you know, curcumin. I mean, you might want to take PhytoGuard along with that, which is a mixture of curcumin and broccoli sprout extract and quercetin and lycopene and EGCG and resveratrol and pomegranate extract is something that I formulated a long time ago, and I've been, you know, going through several iterations, upgrading it each time. That's sort of it's like the complement to Propax, because Propax doesn't contain any of those nutraceutical botanical ingredients.
Right, right. Yeah. And especially, Dan, during the winter, it's very important for you to consistently take some more vitamin D every day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, Dan, thank you for your question. We've got a question from Paul about H. pylori.
Okay.
I'm concerned about Helicobacter pylori infections, particularly increasing the risk of gastric or pancreatic cancer, depending on the strain. I was just tested, and thankfully tested negative. Are there ways for naturally preventing colonization by taking probiotics or by nutrition, washing hands or being careful with food, eating only cooked foods when traveling internationally?
Mm-hmm.
I do frequently travel to Africa for work.
Interesting. Well, you know, first of all, H. pylori is implicated in gastric cancer, and it is implicated in pancreatic cancer now, but only to a very, very slight degree. So, in my opinion, just the presence, even if I thought the guy was going to say, I have H. pylori, I want to get rid of it. What doctors have been doing, I think quite incorrectly, is they've been screening people for H. pylori, even if they're asymptomatic. In other words, H. pylori is very much associated with the risk of gastritis and ulcers. And if you've got an ulcer or gastritis that doesn't heal and H. pylori is present, okay, I get it. You may want to treat it. But they've introduced powerful antibiotic combination drugs, you know, three antibiotics and one acid blocker together. These medications can eradicate H. pylori, but it's becoming more and more resistant, even to triple antibiotics, which is not good. So number one, you acquire antibiotic resistance. Number two, you disrupt your rest of your intestinal balance. And for what? You know, just to reduce your risk, your infinitesimal risk, it's very, very, very low, of having pancreatic cancer or stomach cancer, which can be alleviated by, you know, healthier lifestyle. H. pylori is maybe part of the risk factor profile for these conditions, but it's many other things that far exceed H. pylori as instigators of these cancers. So I wouldn't bother treating it unless you were symptomatic. And B, say you want to treat it, I mean, there are many natural things that seem to treat it. There's certain probiotics that help it. Fish oil seems to help to prevent it. Cranberry extract is actually pretty potent against H. pylori. EGCG seems to act. I actually put a list together once in a presentation of all the scientifically documented things that suppress H. pylori, including, of course, mastic gum, which gained great popularity as a way of suppressing it. Mastic gum is a flavoring ingredient that's from the Middle East. So
another consequence to the triple antibiotic therapy that I've seen with some of our patients personally is they then suddenly get intractable GERD.
Yes.
I mean, really bad, even hoarseness of the voice is just completely changed, and they're not able to take care of that. Well,
and you know why? Because actually, you know, H. pylori is something that is an instigator when it comes to stomach, but it's actually protective when it comes to the esophagus. So you may, you know, reduce your risk of stomach problems, but increase your risk of esophageal problems when H. pylori is eradicated. So that's the reason why, specifically. H. pylori is sometimes associated with the rosacea and other systemic problems. It can create some problems. But, you know. So, I mean, it's actually kind of a fascinating area.
Yeah. Paul, best of luck in your travels, and take your supplements. Thank you very much for your email. Let's see here. We've got another Dan who's emailing us who has a perforated eardrum. He just saw the doctor. The doctor wants to see if it heals on his own. Are there any supplements that might help? Love the show. Longtime listener. All right.
Well, you know, it's a tiny membrane in the ear. And is there something that could accelerate his growth? I mean, generally, you know, we posit certain supplements are helpful for surgical recovery, which involves tissue healing. So, you know, zinc, vitamin C, you know, make sure they have adequate amounts of those things. You know, I won't say that some types of injuries are actually responsive to proteolytic enzymes, but this doesn't seem like a crush injury, you know, like, you know, after plastic surgery or maybe you've sprained your ankle. You know, you may want to take proteolytic enzymes, but I don't think that that's just such a thin membrane. I don't think that that's a big component of that.
Interesting. Wow. All right. Dan, good luck to you. All right. We have an email from Sylvia. I listen to and love your podcasts and frequently save them for future reference. Wow. Podcast encyclopedia, Dr. Hoffman.
Great.
Let's see. I have heard that it is better to have an alkaline system as opposed to an acidic system. What are foods that promote acid, and what are the alkaline foods?
Well,
Sylvia has a second part to her question.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Also, I seem to have lost my sense of smell and taste.
Oh.
Is there any help, or is this unavoidable with age?
Well, that's a different question entirely. So let's tackle the question of the acid alkaline. I think that that's actually one of the real old wives' tales of integrative medicine.
Yes.
It's very, it's a very sort of unidimensional, unsophisticated understanding of human metabolism. And, you know, while there is evidence that a Western-style lifestyle promotes hyperacidity. Well, what's bad about hyperacidity? Well, under hyperacid conditions, the body doesn't function as well. It may promote osteoporosis.
Right.
It may promote, you know, bad stuff. It's just that your body doesn't function well in an acid environment. But the body actually, a healthy body actually regulates the internal environment within a very, very few points of of your pH. So, you know, you respond pretty 7. Well to
7.4, I think.
You know, 7.38, so, you know, something like that. So, you know, I no longer think that it's really important to alkalinize with, you know, fruits and vegetables.
People are drinking alkaline water and all this other stuff. Exactly.
It's bogus. It's bogus.
Yeah. And the other thing is they're relying on the urine test strips.
Which is a mistake.
Your urine pH is not an indication of your blood pH. Not at all.
Right. I mean, so for example, you may be very acidic. And you're inappropriately excreting an alkaline urine. You know, your body may be making, you know, screwing up. So that doesn't reflect your blood composition. And, you know, I've explored this paradigm. I've tried to get a handle on it. I've tried to use various, you know, tests, urine, blood, saliva. It's all confusing. And, you know, the nice thing about the paradigm is it basically encourages you a lot more fresh fruits and vegetables. Meat tends to be acidic.
Which are the alkalinizing foods, right.
Meat tends to be acidic, but actually the most acidic thing around is refined carbohydrates, sugars, and refined starches. Those are the most acidic things that you can consume.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
So
I reviewed a study
you know, many years ago, and it really impressed me. It was a study of a Paleolithic societies that are very few left, you know, untouched virtually by civilization. And anthropologists went in the field and they measured the acidity versus alkalinity of their diets. And what they found is that the vast majority had the balance towards alkaline. But so you might think, oh, they were all vegetarians. Well, no, they weren't. Many of them consumed lots and lots of animal protein. But the net alkalinity or acidity was either neutral or slightly towards alkalinity because of relatively high intake of plant-based foods to offset any of the acidity created by their animal protein intake. So you don't have to be a vegetarian to be alkaline.
Exactly.
The other
Mother Nature has figured it out for us, the alkalinizing foods being the produce we eat and the acid-forming foods being meat, but again, not nearly as acid-forming as sugars and refined carbohydrates. So,
and you can be
really
too alkaline.
That's it.
And you can be too alkaline. And I was once when I was on a vegan diet, and too alkaline is not good either, because it makes one very, very allergic, hypersensitive. You might develop multiple chemical sensitivities. And under those circumstances, I acidified by eating tons of animal protein to flip my balance back more towards neutral. And a lot of my hypersensitivities, I was suffering from chronic hives, allergies, they got better. So, you know, alkalinity is not the goal.
The body wants homeostasis. The body wants equilibrium. So more alkaline is not necessarily better. Right.
Yeah. Finally, on the last of taste and smell, you know, it could be it could be an infection. It could be antibiotics sometimes damage the taste apparatus. It could also, unfortunately, be a harbinger of dementia, because studies have shown that, you know, the olfactory nerve is actually an extension of the brain, and that a reduction in olfactory sensitivity can presage dementia and Alzheimer's. That's, I mean, not to get, you know, this questioner alarmed. But so what are some of the ways to reverse that? Well, actually, some studies have shown that alpha-lipoic acid can have a restorative effect on the nerves. So I would recommend maybe 1,200 international, not 1,200 milligrams of alpha-lipoic acid. We like to use the Alimax CR product, again, from Zymogen.
Yeah. I would add zinc, too.
Zinc,
sometimes that helps the taste buds to return, you know. But that could be something. We don't know how old Sylvia is.
We don't know how old. We don't know if she has chronic sinus problems, if she's taking medication.
Right.
We don't know any of those things. Yeah.
Right. Could be side effects of medication and antibiotics. So there we go.
This is called agusia. It's a medical term for or anosmia, the loss of smell. But agusia is loss of taste. A-G-E. A-G-E. Sorry. A-G-U-E-S-I-A. Loss of taste.
Right.
And, you know, it's a grievous problem because then you lose your appetite. It's harder to discern, you know, whether food is spoiled. It could even be a danger if there's, like, gas escaping in
you
your home.
You want to be careful.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a rule, Sylvia, leftovers should not be in your refrigerator past day four. Day four is it. If you have more leftovers than that, they should be going into the freezer.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Speaking of expiration date, we've gone past our expiration date in terms of time here on Intelligent Medicine. So a reminder to our listeners, please check out our website, avail yourself of our store. By purchasing products from our store, you'll guarantee access to some great products curated by both of us very carefully in terms of quality control, also offered at economical prices, and thereby you'll help to subsidize The Future of Intelligent Medicine, which is a free resource. We'd love to do it, and we want to keep on broadcasting. So thanks for joining us. Thank you, Layla, for today.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you, everyone who's listening.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.
This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.